Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We've got a great mix today for you of state news, national news, and national news that involves state of Georgia public officials. So lots to talk about with Greg Bluestein, who is probably the most active and energetic political reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Glad you're back. You were in Chicago last week on at a bachelor party for your brother.
And in Puerto Rico for my 10-year anniversary with my wife. I've been on a long sojourn, but I'm back now.
One of the team came in here and wanted to know if you'd gotten a tattoo at the bachelor party. Apparently not.
Not that I know of.
Okay. Buddy Darden's back. We haven't seen you in a while, buddy. Former Democratic congressman from the 7th District up in Cobb County. We're glad you're here. You don't have any tattoos, do you?
I'm glad to be back, too. I've been to Paulus Island for the last week with my family, so I'm back and all refreshed, and a lot happened while I was gone.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of it. Can you introduce, though, the guest that we have in our control room?
Yes, I'm so pleased to have my granddaughter, Cecilia Christine Brennan from Arlington, Virginia, in the studio.
And she has the biggest smile on her face. And, buddy, we talked about the fact that I remember her mom when she was her age, Cecilia's
age. That's correct. On the campaign trail with Bill.
That's exactly right. And we're really glad to have Todd Rehm here. He, of course, is a Republican political consultant, but he also oversees the Daily Georgia Pundit blog. That is a great mix of local, state, and national news. So, Todd, thank you for being back with
us. Thanks
today.
For having me. Always happy to be here.
Sure. Let's talk a bit about a couple of stories that have broken just today. At about 11 o'clock this morning, President Trump signed the bill that was passed by an overwhelming margin in Congress, in both houses, imposing new sanctions on Russia. Greg, there had been some question as to whether the president, they passed this bill late last week, it's Wednesday, the president has expressed displeasure about the bill in part because it gives Congress a lot more control over how sanctions can be imposed and how sanctions can be lifted. In fact, that was his complaint. The framers of our Constitution, he said, put foreign affairs in the hands of the president. So he's done it now, though.
Yeah, he's done it. Congress basically put him in a box. I mean, they passed it at near unanimous levels. It would have been very they could have overridden his veto, potentially, if he had tried to do that. But when he signed the bill, he left open the possibility that he might choose not to enforce them by mentioning these clearly unconstitutional provisions, in his words, these parts of the bill that he doesn't find that Congress can enact on them.
Do we have any word yet? I have not seen it anywhere, Buddy or Todd, as to whether perhaps the Justice Department may be empowered to file suit questioning the constitutionality of this measure.
I haven't seen anything, but why, if he thinks it's unconstitutional, did he turn around and sign it? Because having signed the bill, then he, in effect, has agreed to it and given his permission. I was telling the group a few minutes ago that President Nixon, even though he knew his veto was going to be overridden, vetoed the War Powers Act because he thought it was an incursion upon the powers of the executive as opposed to the legislative. And I thought for the few minutes he might go ahead and veto the sanctions bill just on principle, but I don't think the current climate, especially the Russian investigation, allows that.
Well, that strikes me as being exactly right, Todd. You know, Greg just said that Congress put him in a box because of the overwhelming majorities by which they passed this measure, but he's also in a box, as Buddy points out, because of all that's gone on with Russia and his campaign.
I think that's all accurate. I think that what we're seeing is the beginning of a dance between the legislative branch and the executive branch, where the legislative branch has for years wanted to reel back some of the powers that had accreted to the executive. And a lot of us as Republicans were in favor of that when the president was of a different party. But I think a lot of legislators are looking at this as a way of moving back to what they think is the constitutional balance. I think, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, I think we're also going to see that same kind of dance played out between the states and the federal government about the roles of each.
So what's interesting about that, of course, is that we know that right now the president has continued to push health care at the Senate, saying you've got to go back, you've got to work on it again. But talking about what you're talking about, Todd, in the last couple of days, Republican members of the United States Senate have basically said, sorry, we're moving on. We've got other things to do, too, which is yet another example of, at least in this case, the Senate saying we're taking back some of the power we believe is ours. Everybody agree with that or no?
Yeah, I mean, one of the best ways I saw it put over the last week was eyes are rolling in the Senate at increased velocity when it comes to Donald Trump. Mitch McConnell made it very clear that the rest of this month he is not taking up anything to do with health care. He's got other priorities, including yesterday the Senate approved Chris Wray as the FBI director and Atlanta attorney. And next month, it looks like the Senate Health Committee will undergo bipartisan talks over how to solidify and shore up the insurance market. So this is a clear departure from the Obamacare Repeal Act.
And I think that up until now, President Trump has had a distinct advantage in that nobody in Washington knows what to make of him or of his popularity. And there's been a reticence to on the part of a lot of elected officials, appointed officials, to engage him. But this is becoming a much more subtle battle. And the masters of subtlety tend to be those in the legislative branch, I think now more than ever.
Well, as a former House member, I can tell you that every member of the United States Senate considers himself or herself just as important and probably smarter than the president. And so we also have a tussle here among egos and who's in charge and the prerogatives that belong to each particular member of the United States Senate in particular. I think the House... its support is a foregone conclusion, but the real battle is in the United States Senate. And just because the control is in the Republican Party, that means very little under the present rules, which they are not willing to change.
And I think we're also learning about the importance of six-year terms in the United States Senate.
And by the way, that's why I thought the interplay between the Trump administration and Lisa Murkowski, the Alaska senator last week, was so fascinating, because she gets a call from the Interior Secretary kind of with a veiled threat about how much power he holds over the Interior Department and over Alaska lands. And she reminded him, I control the purse strings for the Interior Department. She might have more power than he does when it comes to the Interior Department. So,
not only that, Greg, she can appoint, block his appointment.
Yep.
She can block most any appointment to the Department of Interior by the President of the United States. And you remember the last time she ran, the time before last, Lisa Murkowski lost the nomination, the Republican mm-hmm. nomination, to a Tea Party people. McConnell and the caucus did not support her. She ran as a write-in candidate. Imagine writing in Murkowski mm-hmm. and winning.
And won.
So
it was an astonishing
very little
feat.
Anybody.
There nobody wins in write-in races like that. And of course, Todd, you've got to spell the name correctly. There can't be a misspelling or that vote doesn't count. So Murkowski's not, it's not like voting for John Smith.
If there's anyone in Washington feeling bulletproof these days, it's probably Lisa Murkowski.
I think that's probably right. Let's look at another story that broke in the morning newspapers. The New York Times has a report today saying that the Trump administration is preparing to redirect resources of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division toward investigating and suing universities over affirmative action admissions policies deemed to discriminate against white applicants. The Times bases this story on the fact that DOJ has apparently put out feelers or requests for proposal, however they do that, buddy, looking for attorneys who want to get involved with this case. And of course, that's caused an uproar among civil rights groups just as soon as the news broke.
Well, most of you know about the University of Michigan cases, both from the law school and from the undergraduate school, where they upheld affirmative action for one and turned it down for the other. And that's been a delicate balance. And the swing vote back then was Sandra Day O'Connor, who, of course, is no longer on the Supreme Court. And I think they're counting, if they can get it back to the Supreme Court, with Neil Gorsuch, Justice Gorsuch now. They think that perhaps the situation has tilted and they could change it. But they're playing with fire here, and smarter people than I are going to have to decide.
Why are they playing with fire?
Because it is a very, very contentious and emotional issue, and it's something that everybody feels very strongly about. And most people who are not directly involved in it would rather not see the engagement take place.
You know, Ted, that's a good point that Buddy is making. And I want to turn to you first on this. You've got to wonder why DOJ decided to take this on right now, assuming that they actually have. And we don't have any reason to think the New York Times report is wrong. It's a little bit, I think, like the Trump tweet last week about transgender soldiers not being able to serve. I understand that it plays to the base, but you've got to wonder if this isn't just going out and looking for trouble they don't need right now.
Well, this is an issue that it's not been on fire for a number of years. It was much more talked about, I think, when I was in college 20-some years ago. But it's continued to smolder among right-wing folks. And I say that as one of them. There has been some continuing consternation about affirmative action. I think there is also a continuing interest in reasserting some cultural dominance at the university level, and this is part of that as well. The universities and university professors and administrators have been for the last probably 5 years one of the biggest, juiciest targets for conservatives and for Republicans.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Greg. And of course, not only in things like affirmative action, but we know that there's that conservatives feel university campuses are hotbeds of liberal activity, that professors preach liberal doctrine to their students, which in some cases certainly is absolutely true.
Yeah, I mean, and basically this move cements the rightward tilt of the Justice Department, but there was also a leftward tilt of the Justice Department over President Obama. One quick aside, by the way, Buddy mentioned that University of Michigan case. There was also a high profile, didn't get as much attention, but case in our backyard, 1999 at UGA, there was three white women who said there was reverse discrimination. Basically, at the time, UGA had a points-based system that would award minority students extra points, and they said that was reverse discrimination or unconstitutional. And so this case could have very, if they do pursue this, could have far-reaching implications across the nation.
Well, what's interesting about it, too, is that it comes right on the heels of Attorney General Sessions saying that the Justice Department believes that the civil rights laws protecting people in the workplace do not apply to gays and lesbians. Another example of them reaching out and, for reasons that are a little unclear to me, except I get the politics of it, taking on a fight that may not be the smartest thing to do when you've got so many problems already.
This is a fascinating time to be observing the Department of Justice, because while a certain group of people are very, very much against Jeff Sessions being in that office as Attorney General, and while so many people oppose a lot of his policies and the initiative that he's taken, supposedly with the support of the administration, at the same time, they're being called on to defend him because they believe in the integrity of the Justice Department, in that the Attorney General is not the president's lawyer. The Attorney General is the people's lawyer. And this has turned into a great controversy and a great conundrum for a lot of people in this country.
I'm getting a signal from the control room from Cecilia Christine, Buddy Darden's granddaughter, that it's time to take a break. But before I do, Cecilia, if it's all right with you, I want to read at least one tweet that's come into us at Politics GPB. This is from Lulu, who tweets at DormMom34. She says, Cecilia Christine should set up a Twitter account for Buddy and Lillian, your wife, and teach them how to use it! Exclamation point.
Amen.
It could be at Uncle Buddy.
At Uncle Buddy, that's right. All right, look, we do have to take a break. When we come back, David Perdue's in the news today, and we'll talk about that and a lot more. This is Political Rewind.
Christopher Kimball is bringing his new show, Milk Street Live, to the First Center in Atlanta, September 20th. He'll reveal cooking secrets from around the world, offer taste tests, and invite audience members to join in an onstage cooking contest. Support GPB now, and you'll receive 2 orchestra-level tickets to the show. Attend an exclusive pre-show meet and greet with Christopher Kimball, and receive his newest book, Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Go to gpb.org/milkstreet. That's gpb.org/milkstreet. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Buddy Darden, Todd Rehm, Greg Bluestein in the studio today. Greg, this morning, David Perdue was at the White House. I've got to say, your colleague Tamar Hallerman, I don't know if you've had a chance to see this yet, had the best lead on a story that I've seen this week, even when compared to yours. She said if there was a reward program for visits to the White House, David Perdue would be close to a free meal because he's been there twice this week. He was there today because he and Tom Cotton, Senator Tom Cotton, have been pushing hard on a bill which reflects the administration's feeling. Now we're not talking about undocumented immigrants, illegal immigrants, but about reducing legal immigrants. Let's listen to one of the things that David Perdue said, and then we'll talk.
I'm the only Fortune 500 CEO in Congress, and I've lived around the world much of my career. And I can tell you, nothing that we're going to do right now is more important than this in terms of growing our economy. The reason we need to do this is very simple. Our current system does not work. It keeps America from being competitive, and it does not meet the needs of our economy today. Today, as Tom said, we bring in 1.1 million legal immigrants a year. Over 50% of our households of legal immigrants today participate in our social welfare system. Right now, only 1 out of 15 immigrants that come into our country come in with skills that are employable. We've got to change that.
So, Todd, this bill would cut in half legal immigration in the United States. Is it all right if we tell people that you're doing this as Facebook Live?
Absolutely.
Todd is experimenting, and then we'll let you talk about this issue, with putting this out over Facebook Live.
It's on my own account, under Todd Rehm.
Under Todd Rehm. So if you want to watch us, and I honest to God don't know why you would, go to Todd Rehm on his Facebook page. So, Todd, cutting legal immigration in half and emphasizing the need for highly skilled workers, as opposed to those who have perhaps lesser skills.
And this, I think, illustrates as much as anything what I think David Perdue's unique skill is, and that is taking these broad brush ideas that President Trump puts out there and figuring out how to make something that he wants to have happen work together with what the president has said. He has been consistently since back in the campaign saying, you know, President Trump says XYZ. I take that to mean we're going to do this specific thing. And I think that has really worked well for him. And that's I think a very good job of legislating is. Rather than following blindly whatever the president tweets, you know, from minute to minute, finding something that you think speaks to what you want to accomplish and putting the two together into a concrete proposal.
I think Senator Perdue needs to talk to his cousin, Sonny, the agriculture secretary, because I think he would have a grave, grave disagreement with him about the fact that these people who are coming don't have employable skills. You remember several years ago when the onions rotted in Vidalia in the field. The peaches can't be picked. Just from an agricultural standpoint, we need those immigrants in Georgia. And the same thing is true in the chicken plants. Landscaping business would have to shut down in the Atlanta area without immigrants, illegal or not. So I think his fact that he says that 1/2 of them do not have employable skills, I totally disagree with that. I don't have the facts and figures to back it up, but I'd like to see what his facts and figures are.
In fact, Neil Cassidy, who tweets at Why Isn't This says how many farmers voted for Purdue. By the way, you can join the conversation at PoliticsGPB. Greg, the bill that Purdue and Cotton introduced, they call it the RAISE Act. It's an acronym. It would establish a skill-based point system. Mm-hmm. Currently, we have an employment visa system. The new system would emulate Purdue and Cotton said today, programs that are already in place in Canada and Australia, and they say that those programs seem to have worked very, very well. They say it would eliminate what they call the outdated diversity lottery. Mm-hmm. The diversity lottery is plagued with fraud, advances no economic or humanitarian interest, and does not even promote diversity. The RAISE Act would eliminate the 50,000 visas arbitrarily allocated to this lottery. I suspect they're going to get a lot of pushback on some of these
points. That's a big part of it. I mean, fundamentally, this is a major shift in the nation's immigration policy, which has over the past decade or so allowed an increasing number of legal immigrants rather than a decreasing number. Not only does it do away with that lottery, which is a pretty popular program, and it tends to favor people from parts of the world that don't have as many immigrants coming to the U.S., Africa, some developing countries. But it also would cap refugee levels at 50,000 a year, and that's another big problem.
I thought that was interesting, too. You know, Todd, here's a bill, a Senate bill, that, among other things, would cap refugees at 50,000. Now, for a president who just today said he was reluctant to sign a bill that limits his powers in terms of sanctions or lifting sanctions, I would assume the president has already made it clear he believes that refugees and how many should come in and not come in is in his domain. It's not up to Congress.
Well, and this is again one of those issues that has been a target for the right for a number of years, with increasing vehemence, especially since 2001, and it is an example of what I was talking about. Senator Perdue is finessing an issue to give something to the Republicans who elected these folks without necessarily drawing the firestorm that it might if President Trump had done the same thing. Now, Buddy had said something about how many farmers voted for Trump, and I suspect the number is actually very, very high. Because
I would guess that's right. Yeah.
Certainly, all of them.
Certainly, yeah. Certainly in South Georgia's agriculture-dominated areas, Trump cleaned up and continues mm-hmm. to be very popular, and that's about the electorate who often says they want things that would probably hurt them. You know, it's the same thing that leads to a lot of opposition to health care plans that would have a greater impact on South Georgia and on these places that voted for Trump. But on the other side of the coin, it's probably that cognitive dissonance that allows people to say, I hate Congress, I hate everybody in Washington, D.C., but I love my congressman and I'm voting to reelect him or her.
Before we continue the conversation, I want to read you all a story that broke within the last 15 minutes. The first to report it, at least according to our folks in the control room, was the New York Post. President Trump's approval rating sank to a new low in the latest Quinnipiac University poll, which was released on Wednesday. The poll shows that just 33% of U.S. voters approve of his job performance, while 61% disapprove. That's really kind of an astonishing figure. And what I think is fascinating, Greg, is the New York Post is playing that story. But the New York Post has been a pretty big friend to the administration for the most part.
Yeah, and I'd like to see a closer look at the numbers to see the subset of Republicans, because as we've been seeing all these numbers of him hovering below 40%, his support among Republican primary voters has always been pretty high.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it, because we don't have all the crosstabs. 76% of Republicans approve, only 17% disapprove. Todd, that's a big drop. I mean, Trump in almost every poll had hovered around 85% plus with Republican voters. And what's also interesting is, according to Quinnipiac, men were evenly divided, 47% approving, 48% disapproving. That's another category where you'd expect Trump to still have a pretty big plus in terms of approval, wouldn't you?
Did I hear correctly that you said 76% approval among Republican primary voters?
Among Republican
primary voters.
No, just that Republicans remain his strongest backer, 76% approving. It doesn't say whether they were primary voters or
that
not.
But
that's interesting.
I mean, but I'll say this. That may be down, but 70% is that golden threshold where it's hard to get above 70% on anything. And, you know, that suggests to me that I would expect his popularity to continue to at least affect the way that Republican office holders deal with him and speak about him. And I suspect over time you'll see more folks looking at Senator Perdue and saying, let me figure out how to do what I want to do the way that Senator Perdue has without drawing the if I can get something without drawing the wrath of the White House or of the Republicans in my district or my state who love Donald Trump, that's the way to go.
I have a lot of friends who are Republicans up in Cobb County, and we talk about this quite on a civil basis, I might add, quite often. And even his strongest supporters, who still support him and who will continue to support him, are saying, I wish he'd cut out the tweets. I wish he would cut out some of the showboating. I wish he would change this or change that. So I think he still has a basic support. But a lot of thoughtful people, a lot of thoughtful Republicans, and there are thoughtful Republicans in this state, wish that he would tone it down a little bit and straighten things on more even keel.
Todd mentioned the David Perdue model, but I'm curious to see the Jeff Flake effect. Of course, the Arizona Republican just a few days ago published excerpts of his book that said basically the Faustian bargain that we Republicans have agreed to is not worth it for someone like Trump in the Oval Office. And Trump's top supporters have now said they're openly going to support the primary challenge to him next year, trying to trade off of that high approval rating among Republicans that Trump still
retains. Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it, that the book is called Conscience of a Conservative, which we all, any of us who are old enough to remember, was the name of
Barry Goldwater's book.
Great book back when he was running for president in the mid-60s. Well, let me give you a couple more tweets while we're at a point to go from one story to the next. Catherine Cummings wants to know where our Twitter feed, where we're tweeting from, because she says it's a sharp group of news followers. It's coming out of the control room where Lisa Clark and Jenny Ament and Olivia Rheingold and Tyler Morris are all hanging out. And then she says, control is a relative term when it comes to me. And boy, oh, you said that. Lisa Clark said that. I was going to say, Catherine Cummings is much more observant than I realized. Rick Stewart tweets that somebody should inform Perdue that refugees pay more in taxes than they receive in benefits long term. And he cites a Washington Post story on that. He also says free market policy should apply to labor markets and immigration, too. Sam Burnham says, I'm a conservative, but if Buddy Darden gets a Twitter, I'll follow it. All right. You know what? Why don't we get our second break of the show out of the way now? When we come back, we need to talk about some interesting state news. Now that Senate Republicans have told the president we're not going there on health care, and assuming they stick to that, the ball comes back to Georgia's court, Greg Bluestein, and there are some prominent Republican members of the legislature who are saying it is time to expand Medicaid, which has been a third rail here for several years. So we'll talk about all that and more, but first this break.
On the next Fresh Air.
The next generation would be justified in looking back at us and asking, what were you thinking? Couldn't you hear what the scientists were saying? Couldn't you hear what Mother Nature was screaming at you?
We talk with former Vice President Al Gore about climate change and his new documentary, An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Wow. Al Gore sounded like the next villain on Walking Dead in that promo.
And by the way, he's coming to Georgia next
He'll be
week.
Here for the Netroots, yeah. Conference. So will Keith Ellison, the deputy chair of the Democratic National Committee. What is Netroots? Tell everybody.
Netroots is a progressive conference that's being held in Atlanta from next Thursday to next Sunday.
Yep.
And it's going to have 4,000 or 5,000 progressive activists who are trying to turn the tables on Donald Trump.
Todd Rehm is thinking to himself, I'm staying away from that part of downtown.
I think we as Republicans and as conservatives have a lot to learn from them. And for those of us who think we can pass as progressive, it might be worth the price of admission to go see some of those.
All right. I like that. Thank you for saying that. Greg, Alan Peake and Renee Unterman, Representative Alan Peake, Senator Renee Unterman, began the conversation. They're not alone, but they're the most recent elected officials to talk about it, saying, look, you know, we almost hurt ourselves. If they had passed a new version of a health care bill, it would have probably hurt us because we didn't expand Medicaid when we had the chance before. So we dodged a bullet. Let's move now. Are they going to get anywhere?
I think they will. The governor's kind of leaving it, the ball in their courts. He's saying it's up to the legislature to act on Medicaid before I can, paraphrasing what the governor is saying, at least publicly. Behind the scenes, I'm sure he's going to play a much bigger role. But you're hearing from Lieutenant Governor Cagle. You're hearing from legislative leaders like Senator Unterman, Jay Powell in the House, Dean Burke in the Senate. A lot of influential conservatives are saying it's time to now look towards a waiver program that could hypothetically allow the state to do a limited expansion of Medicaid, but also could help sort of implement some other cost controls and at what they say more flexibility in how the state spends its Medicaid dollars.
What are the implications of this? Do we have any sense of how many Georgians could be covered in some limited form of Medicaid expansion?
If they go in the full-on expansion, which they're not going to do, but if they did a full expansion, 600,000 more Georgians. But if they do a limited expansion, it could be 100,000. It could be at least tens of thousands of additional Georgians could get some sort of coverage.
I think it's finally a recognition of reality among our state legislative leaders that something has got to be done. I hope many of our listeners saw Governor Roy Cooper of North Carolina on PBS News the other night, in which he was talking about the opioid crisis. And this money that will be used on the opioid crisis hopefully will also be funded by Medicaid. And so we're looking at some very, very serious problems in this country. And regrettably, many of the people who are affected by the opioid crisis will, in fact, be Medicaid eligible. So I think this is a very, very important factor in it also, because we've got problems in this state, and we need to forget about who the Democrats are and who the Republicans are. And I commend Representative Peake and Senator Unterman in moving forward.
I was listening this morning to another show on this station in the 9 o'clock hour,
and they second thought.
And they were replaying a tape from about a year ago, and ahead of the 2016 election, there was beginning to be some momentum and a concerted effort to get the political will up to expand Medicaid. And then Donald Trump won it, and that was kind of shelved. But I think that the flip side of the sentiment that drove that is kind of beginning to become fashionable. And that's the idea that Georgia cannot afford to wait for Washington, D.C. to get their act together anymore. And you know, I think that is a potent message for Republicans. I think that something that we have all on my side of the aisle been talking about for years is reining in the role of the federal government, letting the state take primacy in more of these issues. And chaos in Washington, D.C. is a great opening for the legislature to talk not just about how to better use federal funds, but what we can be doing instead of using and relying on federal funds and the strings that are attached.
And the most common thing I heard from lawmakers I spoke with about what a waiver could look like is a two-tiered system that offers full Medicaid coverage to those who are disabled and cannot work, but fewer services for the able-bodied who just haven't been able to find employment yet for whatever reason. There's another provision that other states have pushed. think Michigan is pushing it right now. I can't remember. No, Kentucky is pushing this one right now. It's that it would let require certain new Medicaid enrollees be looking for work or undergoing job training to get those benefits. So there's a sort of conservative angles towards a Medicaid expansion.
And I think that the current opioid crisis kind of gives us a heightened sense of urgency. The way they're talking about it in Washington does not seem to me like they feel the sense of urgency that people in the state of Georgia feel about it. When you have two kids in the same neighborhood in Gwinnett County overdosing in the same day, it is a different kind of thing. And there's a lot we can wait for Washington on. I think that the opioid crisis is really going to put a sense of urgency into the next session of the General Assembly.
But meanwhile, you've got the president in the aftermath of the collapse of efforts to repeal and replace ACA suggesting that he just very well might allow Obamacare to collapse on its own. And one way that could happen is if he orders the federal government to not pay the subsidies that go to Americans who can't afford insurance on their own. And could have a potentially catastrophic effect here in Georgia. Georgia's in the top 10 of states that where the insurance companies, providers get subsidies to insure these people. Somewhere between 62% and 77% of Georgians, somewhere in that range, are getting help. And is the president really going to pull the plug on that? There's a federal court that says he would be within his right to do it, that said it was an illegal subsidy.
I was very surprised that the numbers were that high, especially in the state where we have not done Medicaid expansion, because usually Medicaid expansion has been such an important part of ACA. At the same time, however, I think the president needs to sit back and listen to some people, some advisors who know health care. And I think the president admittedly doesn't understand the intricacies of it. I don't. And I doubt if everybody in this room knows everything about it. But I think he's got some good people around him who I think will cause him to do the responsible thing. The way to do it is really what he originally said he wanted to do. That is to tweak the present system, repair and improve and substitute it with something else. And if he's got something better, you know, let's see it. We just haven't seen it yet.
I was having a discussion on Facebook about this exact issue, and somebody said, if you look at the criticisms that were made of the president's negotiating style as a developer, this falls right in line. He would order some work done and then go back and beat up the subcontractors on price until he got the deal he wanted. And I didn't know what to say to that. I said, you know, there's something to be said for that. And the idea that this is a negotiating position, there's probably more than a little truth to that.
So, all right, let's move on to a quick pass, buddy, at this next item. Yesterday, the Senate approved Atlanta attorney Chris Wray as the new head of FBI. He should be starting that job pretty quickly. He may be over at Justice Department today, for all I know. You know him. He's a guy who is thought very highly of in this city and in Washington as well.
He is, and I can think of the only reason he must be doing the job is because he feels a call and a sense of duty and responsibility, because it sure doesn't make sense from a financial standpoint, or even a political standpoint. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say he wants to serve and do what's right for the country.
Well, he's an attorney. He's leaving a position. He's a partner at King & Spalding, right, which is one of the biggest law firms in the Southeast, and really in the country. Oh, come on, buddy. His partner fees over there, he couldn't afford to take a cut and pay for a while.
He made $6.2 million to this point. Since the first of the year, and to give up that type of money for a job for the federal government that pays under $200,000 is surprising. So I'm going back to my whole point is that he must be totally dedicated and thoroughly committed to serving his country, you know, because it doesn't make sense politically or financially.
So he's also the latest Georgia figure to find a very prominent place in the Trump administration. And when you talk about roots, he has deep roots in Atlanta. He married, I mean, he's from Virginia, but he married his wife is, what, seventh generation Atlanta?
Yeah.
Her relatives were publisher of the Atlanta Constitution, so very deep roots here.
You know, we on this show, and certainly on every show, including on the conservative shows, there's a lot of talk about President Trump kind of out of control, tweeting haphazardly about anything that is on his mind. He hasn't said a word about Chris Wray, to the best of my knowledge. And I suspect that's a pretty good sign, really, that at least for the time being, he realizes he'd better keep his hands off his new FBI director. We'll see how it works.
For the time being, but he won't be able to stand it. He won't last 1 year without jumping on to him about something, and that troubles me, but we'll just see what happens.
But for the time being, the proof was in the vote count. It was 92-5.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Unbelievable that bipartisan support for Chris Wray.
All right, let's move on, if we can. By the way, one other quick item, and then we'll move to the next more robust conversation. Buddy Carter, interesting, Greg. The Daily Jolt at your Political Insider webpage says that Buddy Carter is going to have 9 town halls in his congressional district next week, according to the Town Hall Project. Boy, for a congressman, for most congressmen are having maybe a phone town hall.
Yep.
But he has no fear.
And remember, he was one of the only congressmen in the Eastern Seaboard who were Republicans to have a town hall earlier when all the town hall conflagrations were going on. And it got pretty, his town halls got pretty testy. So hats off to him for continuing to do public meetings.
Yeah, we'll see how they play it. It'll be fascinating to see. This past week, law enforcement officials from around the United States this week had been in town at their annual conference convention. Jeff Sessions came in and spoke yesterday. He gave a pretty, we rolled on it. We wanted to see if there's anything he said that would be noteworthy, newsworthy to bring to your attention. He gave a pretty standard pro forma speech in which he said, we're going to back law enforcement with everything we've got. That makes sense that the Attorney General would say that. But after the session in which the AG spoke, there was a news conference in which the outgoing head of this organization, Perry Tarrant, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name, made a comment about the president last week in his speech, saying that he wishes that law enforcement weren't quite so gentle, essentially, with crime suspects. Made comments suggesting, you know, if they bump their head when they get into the car, that's okay. Here's what the head of the organization said at the news conference.
The president's remarks a few days ago caused us a little bit of concern. We had the opportunity to have a follow-up conversation most recently with the Attorney General of the United States. Part of our conversation was about the professionalism of law enforcement and the potential harm that off-the-cuff comments like those made by the president have in detracting from the legitimacy and detracting from the trust that local law enforcement communities have. Noble has always been the conscience of law enforcement. We are not thugs, we are professionals. We fully expect law enforcement around the country to behave as professionals.
So there was a lot of pushback on the president's remarks, including that statement, Todd. And the White House insists the president was joking. But it's just another one of those off-teleprompter moments that, again, causes him grief.
Well, I want to say two things. One is that I think there has been a sentiment among a lot of folks that the previous administration did not have law enforcement's backs at all time. Whether that's true or not, that was certainly a perception among a lot of people. And so Jeff Sessions saying that, I think, is more than just pablum. The other thing is, I think we've had a lesson this week that when the president tweets something now, It is not an enforceable, actionable statement of policy. The DOD pushed back on people saying, oh, what are you going to do after he tweeted? And he said, and the military response was, the same thing we do whenever anybody tweets, nothing. We respond to orders on paper through the proper channels. And, you know, I think...
Well, this wasn't a tweet, though. This was
Well, yeah, you're right. But even the things that he says on camera are not necessarily well thought out, actionable statements of policy, for better or for worse. I think if the Trump administration really wanted to give journalists in Washington a hard time, they would stop tweeting and stop saying stuff like this, because it's easy to cover, you know, what you can call a gaffe or what you can, you know, what you can say is outrageous that he said. But we're learning that not everything he says, not everything he does, not everything he tweets, it may reflect his thinking. It may reflect a fleeting moment of something. It's not but it's not policy.
As much as anybody. However, there are just some things you don't joke about, and that's one of them, the treatment of people in custody.
All right, let me move on, because there's a story that I want to get at least a little bit of time on, and we can continue this conversation on Friday's show. Very strange story that NPR broke, but it's been getting a lot of traction. Many of you pay attention to the news cycle over a period of months, know that some time ago, Fox News reported that Seth Rich, who'd been a worker for the DNC, who was unfortunately murdered in the district, they reported that he may have been connected. He may have been a leak to WikiLeaks, sending information to them that they published, and that it was possible that perhaps he was murdered because of this. And the president's attorney, Jay Sekulow, getting way far away from his work as the president's lawyer, actually said on a TV show, this looks like it was murder. Now, NPR has reported, Greg, that the Fox reporter on this story may have the big donor to the president's campaign may have actually coordinated with the White House how this story was reported. Here's what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said yesterday about this.
The president had no knowledge of the story, and it's completely untrue that here the White House involvement in the story. And beyond that, this is ongoing litigation, and I'd refer you to the actual parties involved, which aren't the White House.
So the donor is Ed Butowski, and right now there's a lawsuit. Rod Wheeler, who is an investigator hired to investigate this for Fox News, is suing Fox because he says he's been misrepresented. And the notion, and there was actually an email that that Rod Wheeler saved, which said the White House, the president is aware of this story and he wants you, no pressure, but keep going.
Yeah, in the lawsuit, Wheeler says that this was actually brought up during the campaign to deflect public attention from all the concern about Trump's ties to the Russian government. And to say this lawsuit is explosive is an understatement.
Anybody?
I'll have to wait and see, let the facts come out. I can't really get my arms around it except to say it's very disturbing, but I don't want to prejudge the situation until I hear more.
All right, let's listen to Rod Wheeler, who talked about this just the other day.
I do believe I was used as a pawn in this entire thing. I think their goal, based on the emails and the voicemail messages that I got from Ed Butowski, was to debunk this Russian hacking narrative.
And then Butkowski was interviewed on CNN last night now I'm blocking who interviewed him last night. I'll get back to it. But let's listen to what he said.
Did he know why you wanted to meet with him?
No.
So he just took a meeting?
As a matter of fact, yeah, because I said, Sean, I was going to be in town. I had something I wanted to talk to you about. My conversation with Sean about this recording lasted about 1 minute. He said, Ed, I don't know anything about it. I don't want to know anything about it. I can't do anything.
Sorry for the momentary lapse there. It was Chris Cuomo who did the interview. And he wanted to know if Butkowski was not working with the White House, why he met with Sean Spicer. Spicer acknowledges that he met with him. You know, here's the problem with stories like this, Todd. We don't know. I mean, if a news organization as respectable as NPR reports this out and then it's picked up by other respectable news organizations, it's worthy of our attention. But it's another one of those stories that we have to – we don't know whose reality we're living in at any given time. And the White House has created a situation in which we're always skeptical about what's real and what's not.
And at some level, that may reflect their desire to have sown doubt, or at least the desire of some folks in the shop. One of the things that I've learned about campaigns is that there are folks who will come up to you and say, I want to do XYZ crazy thing to help your candidate get elected. And the way you always do – the way you handle that is – some form of a polite brush off, usually sending a minor campaign aid of some sort to listen, take it seriously. Oh, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. And show them the door without committing to anything. And so this could be anywhere from a situation where somebody just did some crazy stuff, had a meeting, thought he was being taken seriously, and continued to do crazy stuff. That is, for me, the simplest explanation for a lot of the sideshow that surrounded the Trump campaign. I can imagine they had people coming up to them all day, every day, at every event with some crazy idea that was going to put him in the White House. And you have to be polite. You have to pretend to take them seriously. And you know, when it's not appropriate to take any action, you just show them out the door.
Yeah, the problem you've got here is there's a voicemail and an email that Rod Wheeler has that suggests that the president himself was very interested in seeing Fox move this story forward. And by the way, Fox retracted.
Yeah, I was about to say, Fox actually retracted that story in May.
That story, and in part because Seth Rich's parents were distraught and threatening to sue over this.
Plus, the White House has had to backtrack on so many things. Most people think that this might be another situation just like that because of exactly what Todd said.
All right, we are out of time, but we do have enough time to tell you there's another news story that just came to the attention of our folks in the control room. Senator Lindsey Graham, The Hill reports, is against a merit-based immigration bill unveiled earlier Wednesday by President Trump and Senators Perdue and Cotton. Last month, Graham renewed his proposal for the DREAM Act, and he warned Cotton and Perdue's bill could hurt both the agriculture and tourism industry. So even some pushback from Republicans, so it'll be fascinating.
You can't lose too many more.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to watch how that bill moves forward, and we'll keep you on top of it in subsequent shows. Okay, we are out of time. We'll be back on Political Rewind Friday at 3. Buddy Darden, Todd Ream, Greg Bluestein, thank you for a really, really terrific conversation today. On Friday, among other people, we're going to have Tim Echols, Public Service Commissioner Tim Echols, because we've got this big story about what happens now that South Carolina's nuclear projects, like Georgia's, seem to be in complete financial disarray. So Tim will join us for that conversation tomorrow on Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock. Our conversation with Lawrence Wright, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Looming Tower and probably one of the country's leading experts on Islamic terror, its roots, and how it progressed in the Middle East and here in the United States. That's Two-Way Street tomorrow at 2. So we'll see you then. I'm Bill Nygut. Have a great evening.